listening to a program produced in 2010 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more about Aloud, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. You know, I grew up in Los Angeles, and the names Chandler's and LA Times were virtually synonymous. That was a given when I watched Peter Jones's great film, Inventing LA, The Chandlers and Their Times, but the film itself and the history that it presented was quite a revelation. As the late David Halberstam wrote, no single family has dominated any major region of the country as the Chandlers have dominated Southern California. They did not so much foster the growth of Los Angeles as invent it. So watching the film was really learning the history of my own city. Jones's film was awarded a prestigious Peabody Award this past spring. The judging panel wrote, digging into the lives and machinations of the first family of Los Angeles newspapers, documentary filmmaker Peter Jones finds drama enough for several feature films, and that's certainly true. So tonight we'll see some clips from the film, and then, as I said, Pat Morrison will moderate a conversation with filmmaker Peter Jones and Bill Boyarsky, who wrote the book Inventing LA, based on Peter Jones's film, and then we'll open up for questionings. A few notes on our participants tonight. Bill Boyarsky is a political columnist for TruthDig.com, and he blogs for LA Observed. And in his 30 years with the Los Angeles Times, Bill Boyarsky was a political writer, featured columnist, and city editor. He was a member of reporting teams that won 3 Pulitzer Prizes, and he is the author of 2 biographies of Ronald Reagan, and he authored Big Daddy, Jesse Unruh, and The Art of Power Politics, as well as Los Angeles, City of Dreams. And together with his wife, Nancy, who's here tonight, he co-authored Backroom Politics. Peter Jones, the filmmaker, began his career as a broadcast journalist, and in 1987, he formed Peter Jones Productions, originally specializing in documentary films relating to the history of the motion picture industry. His special on Judy Garland won a 97 Primetime Emmy Award for Outstanding Informational Series, and Stardust, the Betty Davis Story, garnered Jones and his team an Emmy nomination for Outstanding Nonfiction Special and an Emmy for Outstanding Writing for Nonfiction Programming. And Pat Morrison, whom we all read every day and listen to every day with great joy, is a writer and columnist, as you know, for the Los Angeles Times and host of the daily Pat Morrison Public Affairs Program on KPCC 89.3 FM. She's won 6 Emmys and 6 Golden Mike Awards as founding host and commentator on Life and Times Tonight, the nightly news and current affairs program on KCET. Many of you have seen her wonderful book published by Angel City Press on the Los Angeles River. So please join me in welcoming all of our panelists tonight, Bill Boyarsky, Peter Jones, and Pat Morrison. Thank you so much.
Louise, as Louise said, we will have questions, and I know that some of you have been saving these up for about 90 years. Now, I did, before I came here, I went into the Times lobby and I communed with the busts of the Chandler publishers, Harrison Gray Otis, Harry Chandler, Norman Chandler, Otis Chandler, and was attuned to what was going on. I did get a message from Harrison Gray Otis, who told me to tell all of you to bleep off. And I just told Peter I was reading up on the documentary, which is fabulous if you've not seen it, and Bill's book, terrific if you have not read it. And PBS, on its page about the Peabody Awards, managed to misspell the name Chandler, which just reinforces my fury about East Coast bias toward Los Angeles and California. But what we're going to be talking tonight and seeing about bits of the documentary, as you heard David Halberstam's famous quote, this is the family that shaped Los Angeles. For ill or for good, what this city is in no small part because of the vision that the Chandlers had. So we'll be looking first at a moment, and I think we'll set up with this moment. It's kind of a general background from the documentary about the Chandlers in Los Angeles and how it was a marriage in so many ways, a battling relationship and a loving one, and one that gave us the offspring that we have around us today. So if we could see that first clip from the documentary. It's like Euripides meets Oprah. How, Peter Jones, did you get your head around this, and how did you tease out the Chandlers without getting sucked back into making this just a documentary about LA itself?
Right. Well, I'd always wanted to tell a story about my hometown, and I knew that there was, I didn't want to do a survey show. I wanted it to run like a feature film and take you on a real thrill ride. I read a book by Dennis McDougall called Privileged Son, Otis Chandler and the Rise and Fall of the LA Times Empire, and that gave me the idea, well, stories and history is best told through the individual experience, and if I take the five characters involved in the story of the Los Angeles Times from the first publisher, Harrison Gray Otis, through Otis Chandler, people are going to get a sense of the Los Angeles Times as an institution, and then along the way, the story of the city of Los Angeles just emerges through their lives.
It's such a paradoxical story because it is, at its heart, a family story with a family feud, but it's set against the panorama of Los Angeles, and it's like the old saying that when the elephants fight, it's the grass that gets, you know, trampled. These are the elephants fighting, and Los Angeles was the grass.
Right. Yeah, that's what made it so much fun is, you know, the whole story that there was no natural harbor in Los Angeles, and Harrison Gray Otis said, well, if we really want to compete with San Francisco, which has a natural harbor, well, let's just build one, and let's have the federal government pay for it. And he got them $3 million to build San Pedro and beat Collis Huntington of the Southern Pacific Railroad, who already had everything in place in Santa Monica Bay.
So, yeah, if you go out there today, you see that little sign that said, here once stood the long pier of Santa Monica.
Yeah.
That's all that's left of that.
Uh-huh. Right.
And so, Bill, you and I work at the paper, and so we've absorbed this lore over the years, but I still learn things from Peter's documentary, and I still learn things from your book about this family that had this success trajectory but seemed bent on destroying the very thing they'd created.
Well, I learned quite a bit doing it from the documentary and then from the marvelous oral histories that Peter obtained and that I had access to. And they told me things about the family that I really didn't know and sort of changed my view. I thought that Harry Chandler was an absolute mean old pirate and with very little respect for ethics or law or anything like that, but nobody else had it in those days either. But he was also...
A successful pirate then.
Right. But he was also quite a character, and his daughter-in-law, Buff Chandler, in an oral history that she did with her husband, told these great stories about his eating habits and also his interest in ED. We now call it ED, but they didn't at that time. And in that pre-Viagra era, he was very interested in cures for this. And he hit upon the idea, he'd heard about injection of monkey glands or goat glands in certain areas, I guess. And he was always trying to get his friends to do it, and they wouldn't do that, and I guess he didn't either.
They're all supposed to join together and
he offered one of the editors at the Times $100 if he would have this operation, and he told him that, if it works, we'll have a hell of a story, and if it doesn't work, we'll expose the doctor as a crook. But it was unclear whether the editor ever had that operation. So there was...
Well, it, to my knowledge, most editors, you know, didn't need any encouragement in that area anyway. Peter?
That was one of the great moments when we were going through the Huntington Library and the collection of the Los Angeles Times and the Chandler family itself, when we came across these tapes that hadn't seen the light of day. An editor named Jim Bassett was commissioned by Otis Chandler to write a history of the paper. Well, everybody in their oral histories was so frank, Otis rejected Bassett's book, and they did, as Otis called it, a kiss-ass biography by another guy named Marshall Burgess. But to actually hear in their own words the stories about how the paper started and about their relationship within their own family, we use this to tremendous effect in the film, and it really gives it an intimate, personal feel.
And yet Harry Chandler had all of his private papers burned, as I remember from Bill's book. So what were these oral histories? How telling, how revealing were they?
Well, it was them remembering the stories that had been passed down to them about Harry Chandler. Now, all this is passed down. As you know, families and stories can change in the telling. But the most important thing was really hearing Buff Chandler's own story growing up as a girl in Long Beach. Her father was the mayor, and the Chandler family didn't think she was good enough. And that we can get into that later, but... Anyway, hearing in their own words the dynamics within the family just bring it so home and so intimate.
They thought she wasn't good enough because her family was in trade, and yet,
yeah.
Right? And Harrison,
retail.
Yeah. Retail. And Harrison Gray Otis, you know, had been a multiple failure and a printer before
he
came to Los Angeles. So where'd they get all hoity-toity?
Well, because Harry Chandler, their father, who was the son-in-law of General Otis, had made a substantial amount of money, and his daughters were brought up very well, and they were spoiled. So in just one generation, they became hoity-toity.
And Bill, they really were oligarchs. I mean, Harrison Gray Otis lived high, wide, and handsome, and you know the house in San Marino, the Hancock Park. And
right. They really did. They were, they lived, they were like royals. And, you know, and... us working there, we were like people who maybe we worked in some capacity at Buckingham Palace.
We tugged our forelocks.
And there were these royals up there who we knew about and even knew slightly, you know, like Otis Chandler, we knew him. But we didn't really know him. They were too grand to expose themselves to people like us.
And yet, like Richard Corey in the E.A. Robinson poem, you know, these are people who are very flawed, who have tremendous flaws. And in some ways, they tripped over their own egos. And I want to talk a little later about the feud and the family, but the effect on Los Angeles of having, you know, the publisher of the most important paper in town, then in Southern California, and arguably in the West, really shaping the political fortunes and making from the harbor to the aqueduct, making Los Angeles look the way it did. Maybe before we play the bit about water, Bill, maybe you can speak to, and then Peter can speak to, the political influences, what they actually did in Los Angeles and to Los Angeles.
Well, what they did was they created the Los Angeles in their image. I mean, General Harrison Gray Otis came and saw the possibilities of the place, and his son-in-law also did, and they created the Los Angeles just by force of character and whatever means they could. I mean, they saw the need for water. They brought the water down from the Owens Valley. They bought all the land in the San Fernando Valley, which was the basis of their fortune. I mean, and that really created the suburban Los Angeles in the style of Los Angeles that we have today.
So publishing was almost a sideline, really, for the...
Right, for Harry Chandler. As Dorothy Chandler says in her own words in the film, she said, Harry was a land developer. He was not a publisher. His eye was on the future of building Los Angeles and making Los Angeles what it is today. He really didn't give a fig about publishing and didn't even understand what journalism was about. The paper was just an engine for economic growth and boosterism.
So let's look at a moment from the documentary having to do with water. And of course, everyone knows from the film Chinatown, the story of how water was brought to Los Angeles is a notorious one. And it was very much Harrison Gray Otis doing with the Los Angeles Times that made that happen, for good or ill. To this day, LA is doing penance. We had to change the way the water works up in the Owens Valley to try to restore something of what had been pretty rich farmland that actually had lakes on their own, and now had LA had essentially stuck a straw in the Owens Valley, the Owens River, and brought all the water here. Now, there's so much mythology, Peter, about all of this part of it. What myth busting did you find, and what myths were reinforced as you were working on this?
You know, that's so tough because the primary material is so scattered. We tried to keep it to what we could verify about the cattle ranchers, the city officials posing as cattle ranchers. That much we knew was actually true, and that a gentleman named Moses Sherman, who was on the City Water Commission, was also a member of the syndicate that Harry Chandler and Colonel Otis were a part of that did actually buy up 44,000 acres in the San Fernando Valley. So we did make the direct connection there. Everything else I just thought was myth-making, and we didn't include it.
Like what? Come on.
Well, well, this idea that they raped the Owens Valley, the cattle ranchers did indeed sell the rights to the city officials that they thought were cattle ranchers, but they were paid very handsomely for those water rights. So it wasn't that they just blew up there and took the land. The cattle ranchers were paid very handsomely.
And Bill knows this. There's a statue in front of City Hall to a man named Frank Putnam, who had been a mayor who was instrumental in all of this operation. And it just delights me that the fountain is dry. So, Bill, the paper was used as an instrument to achieve all of this. It was used as a bully pulpit. It was used as a billy club. Talk about that period when the Times really did dictate politics in L.A. and how, down to this day, it has shaped the kind of politics we have.
Well, it totally dictated politics, not only for their money-making projects like the land development, but reflecting their right-wing politics, their anti-union attitude. I mean, the unions did blow up the paper, and people said, I can understand why there would be hard feelings. But their violent anti-union, pro-Republican of the most conservative nature. And I always thought that pro-corrupt police department, as long as the police department would keep the unions down. I thought that having, you know, when Pat and I came to the paper, it was long after that, and it was a upright, admirable place. But I thought those years left a stain on the paper, on its reputation. And, you know, you'd go through town, on our reporting rounds, and you'd find people who remember those days with great bitterness. And it took a long, long time for the paper to overcome that. And I thought that was a very bad thing that the Chandlers did.
Yeah, they were so devoted to Richard Nixon, even Norman Chandler, the coverage of Nixon, the promotion of Nixon, you know, from all the way from Congress into the White House. I mean, if Nixon broke wind, they said, oh, there's a warm southerly breeze coming. You know, the man could do no wrong. But why is it, Bill, that when we get to the Otis Chandler generation here, where we have Otis Chandler parting company with a lot of the politics of his family, certainly with a lot of the way that journalism was practiced, what was going on in the city and what was going on in the family?
Well, Otis Chandler, who got the job over the objections of his relatives, well, I guess we'll talk about that later. But Otis Chandler, in the first place, politically was sort of a moderate Republican, and secondly, he saw that the paper was not succeeding. It was basically a paper that was aimed at Hancock Park, Pasadena, San Marino, maybe Arcadia. It was a paper for...
Line stopped at Temple City.
Oh, definitely. Not Temple City, no. And it was a paper for basically WASPs, written and edited by WASPs, and you never saw any stories about African Americans or Latinos or anybody with a complex name or any, you know, Jews. None of them were in the paper. And Otis saw that this paper would not succeed. And it was not only a right-wing rag, but it was an extremely dull right-wing rag. And so he knew that this paper had to circulate to the masses. Mass and class was what he said. And so, speaking purely commercially, he knew that he had to expand, he had to have a great sports section, he had to have a view section, he had to have stories that reflected the diversity of Los Angeles in that paper, or else it would die. And so those were some of the things that pushed him along.
Now, when Otis Chandler took over as publisher, this was a source of great division in the family. I'm going to ask Peter about it in a minute. Otis fired a shot across his family's bow by commissioning a reporter named Gene Blake to write a series of stories about the John Birch Society. Who were the chief funders of the John Birch Society in Los Angeles? They were the Chandler family. So maybe you'd like to take that little family feud from there.
Yeah, well, Otis did commission, 1 year after he became publisher, a writer named Gene Blake wrote a five-part series exposing the right-wing bigotry of the John Birch Society, which felt that Eisenhower, they called him a Soviet dupe, and the United Nations a communist front. I mean, those were their descriptions, not mine. And, the family was very upset because Philip and Alberta, who were Norman Chandler's brother and sister-in-law, were members of the John Birch Society. Now, they weren't alone in hating what Otis did with that five-part series. The week after it appeared, 15,000 subscribers stopped the paper. They stopped taking the paper. Otis ran a front-page editorial that he wrote himself defending his paper's journalism, which was a huge act in support of the reporters and really helped morale.
And what was the genesis of this rift? Was it all about Buff Chandler?
Yes, we traced it as far back as 1922. We were saying earlier that Dorothy Buffum wasn't good enough for Norman's siblings or for Norman's mother, Marion. And when Dorothy Buffum married Norman Chandler, the sisters absolutely said no, they weren't for this marriage. And in 1922, August 26th, none of Norman's siblings attended the marriage of Dorothy Buffum to Norman Chandler. All but one, his youngest sister, Helen, came to the wedding. There began the feud between the publishing Chandlers and what we call the non-publishing Chandlers.
Now, there's something to be said for Harry Chandler, and Bill, maybe you'll talk about this. Harry Chandler was what they called in the teens and 20s air-minded. He believed in the future of aviation. He believed in the future of movies. And these are things that he did do for Los Angeles.
Well, that's right. He was really a man with a very modern vision, and and he would, his son and his daughter-in-law would said in their oral histories how he would, in the evenings, he would go down to his office at the paper after dinner, and people would come in to see him. He would see somebody during the day, and they said they wanted to talk to you, and he'd say, come in at 8 o'clock or come in at 9 o'clock. Anyway, and he would hold court there like a old political boss, or really like the Godfather. And one day, his star reporter, Bill Henry, brought in a young aeronautical engineer named Donald Douglas, who told him of his plan to, he needed $15,000 to complete a contract to build some planes for the Navy. And Harry Chandler said, well, I don't know anything about you, and I don't know anything about airplanes. But he says, if Mr. Henry says you're okay, you're all right with me. And he helped him raise the money. And then he helped bring a small, obscure engineering school in Pasadena into the Caltech we know today, and he helped finance their wind tunnel. The wind tunnel was where Donald Douglas's DC-1 and DC-2 and DC-3 were tested, and the DC-3 became the bulwark of civil aviation and the beginning of our aerospace industry. And I was trying to think when I'm thinking about these Chandlers, what were the worst thing the Chandlers did, and what were the best things the Chandlers did? Mm-hmm. And I always thought this was one of the best things the Chandlers did.
Okay, and the worst?
The worst thing the Chandlers did, I agree with Peter, stealing the water. We drink it. I mean, it's really not bad water at all. The worst thing they did was imposing their anti-labor right-wing philosophy in the paper and in the city, and denying anyone who disagreed with them a place in the paper, and having the police department as a tool of the newspaper and of the business establishment literally arrest people on occasion, like Upton Sinclair, for free speech. That was the worst thing that I thought the Chandlers did.
I'm reminded of this question because we're sitting in this library, the part of the library restored after the 1986 fire. It bears the names of philanthropists like Laud Cook and the McGuire Gardens and places like that. And yet, for all of the influence of the Chandlers, there is nothing in this town except a street in the valley that has their name. There is no Chandler Foundation. There is no Chandler Building. There is no Chandler Charity. Why is that, Peter?
Well, because Harry Chandler had 8 kids, and most of them were females, and they married. So there were names like Williamson and Babcock and Crow, and those names you do see around town. So to be fair, they weren't all Chandlers. They did marry into other names. And so, but still, Harry Chandler did not want anything he did to be made public. So he was a very private person, didn't want his name out there, except for that little facade to Chandler Boulevard in the valley. That's it. But the other members of the family that did have different names, they did get involved in the opera and the music center. They supported the music center. But, yeah, you don't see the name Chandler.
But speaking of the music center, if there was a single Chandler who brought civic Los Angeles into literal physical creation, it was Dorothy Chandler.
Dorothy Chandler, and who's remembered in the Dorothy Chandler Pavilion at the theater at the music center.
And who was so good at raising money that, was it she once chased into the bathroom for a check, Charlton Heston? Into the men's room?
She was Kirk Douglas.
Kirk Douglas.
$5,000, and then she tore it up and wanted more.
But, you know, I think it's interesting. This auditorium is named after Mark Taper, right? Well, Mark Taper was Jewish. He was a great land developer. He helped develop San Fernando Valley and Lakewood. And places like that. And the other great Jewish families who were involved in either land development or the movie business were not part of the Los Angeles, the power of Los Angeles, the Los Angeles establishment, which was anti-Semitic. And Dorothy Chandler, knowing that she had to raise a lot of money to build this music center, and Otis Chandler, knowing that his paper had to expand out into the West Side to survive and to expand, she began cultivating the Mark Tapers of the world, and brought them in, and the Mark Taper, the theater in up in the music center, named after Mark Taper, is an example. Another one, the theater named after Howard Amundsen, another person who was brought in. And that was a huge contribution to Los Angeles. Also, her bringing in her artistic contribution, bringing in Zubin Mehta to conduct the symphony, and Gordon Davidson to put on his plays that outraged her, but she still went and saw them. Right?
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the things that made her so distinctive from the rest of the Chandlers.
Yeah, and I would say her greatest contribution was her son, Otis Chandler. And we do have a clip that begins with Dorothy talking. This is where you'll hear the Chandlers speaking in their own words, which is, to me, the most fun and exciting part of making the film. But it does begin with a clip of Dorothy holding Otis in her hands, saying, you know, I'm just not the type of person that loves every little baby. Great. Thanks, Mom. But anyway, that's how this sequence starts, if you wanted to.
Let's see Otis and Mother. I have to tell you, even after Otis retired, he would write to us and send emails to us. And, of course, Bill can describe a great moment in the newsroom with Otis calling in. But to get a note from Otis, to have him email you or call you, it was as though you'd been summoned to Buckingham Palace to be given some honor, because this is a man who had fought all sorts of forces, including his own family, because of the newspaper that he believed in. His eldest son, Norman, died young, would otherwise perhaps have been publisher himself, and I think therein may lie the basis to explain what happened with the newspaper. Bill, do you want to talk about the change, the handover, and how it was lost to the family, even though Harry Chandler said that he had made it airtight, that it would never leave the hands of the Chandlers?
Well, these Chandlers, we called them the evil Chandlers. They were out there lurking for years and waiting. And waiting. And the paper, I won't bore you with the details, but the paper was part of a complex sets of trusts set up by Harry Chandler. And somehow the word was believed by Norman Chandler and all that it was written in a way that the family would always have to keep control, and that Otis would always have control. That wasn't what was true at all. I mean, it was a simple deal that you had to have enough votes to win on this board. It's like any other board, and at a certain point, Otis didn't have enough votes to win, and that was the beginning of the end. He appointed as his successor somebody who we may meet, Tom Johnson, who was a very fine person and a wonderful publisher. And unfortunately, he was a Democrat and a protege of Lyndon Johnson, and had worked in the Johnson White House and had worked for the Johnson family. And I never could understand why Otis could appoint a person like that, such a Democrat, with these people lurking over there. And meanwhile, the newspaper business was changing. The paper was quit growing. The readers were leaving us. Far-seeing people could see the end. Otis Chandler was dismissed from the boards that he had sat on, humiliated, went back to his ranch up in Ventura County. Tom Johnson was dismissed, and finally the paper was sold to the company that owned the Chicago Tribune. But before it was, these Chandlers over there had hired a man to be the chief executive officer, who had been passed over for the CEO of General Foods. And not having made it in the cereal business, went into the newspaper business. We called him the cereal killer. And his name was Mark Willis, and he believed in something that we thought was, and everyone else in the business was, quite revolutionary at the time, merging the advertising and the news departments, which we had always thought would be independent. Of course, today that's the way things are done. But in 1999, it was quite shocking. And he did that, and it resulted in a huge scandal and embarrassment for the paper when the Staples Arena developers and the Los Angeles Times Magazine collaborated on a single edition.
And or colluded.
Colluded.
And the, way of thinking.
Basically, the magazine didn't control what went into it, and it became a huge scandal and outraged Otis tremendously.
And it set in motion, Peter, the events which mean that today we have not only Tribune ownership, but Tribune bankruptcy.
Right. Yeah, I'll let Bill is so good at unraveling these tangled webs.
Well, it Otis was up there in exile, up in his ranch in Ojai, living with Bettina, and observing what was going on, and was very angry. And I guess he wanted to do something. I was the city editor, and one day my phone rang at the city desk, and I had actually answered it. I was so busy that I never answered my phone, but I had vowed I was going to answer all my calls this day. And it was Otis. And he said that he had a message for me to deliver to the staff. And see, I was the last person he knew there. I mean, who had any kind of authority to do anything with, you know, I could get something done. And I was the only person I think he knew in that position. And I said, "You do?" And he said, "Yes." And he says, "Yes, I want to deliver a message to the staff." And I said, "Well, exactly how do you want to deliver it? Do you want me to put it up on the bulletin board?" Which is what I was hoping. And then I could put it up on the bulletin board and go home. Or deliver it personally. And he said, both. And I said, anyway, I took down the message, and it was an extraordinary afternoon as I was taking down his long, eloquent letter, which I think that the people who run the Los Angeles Times should read every day. And I took it down, and my bosses asked me not to read it to the staff, but I felt that I had to, because he had created this great newspaper. None of us would have worked there when it was a right-wing Republican rag, and he'd made it something, and we owed him that. And so I went ahead. I remember another act of heroism that I didn't learn about later, real heroism, was my secretary, Wendy Cota, was taking this document from my computer and translating it into Word. We had a backward computer system. Anyway, she was running back and forth, and her boss asked her to stop. She was a secretary. Her husband was a working-class guy, and they had two kids, I think, and she was pregnant with the third. They had everything to lose, and she continued and just did it all afternoon, helping me with this. And she told me about it her last day at the paper when we were out to lunch, and I thought, you know, that was the most heroic thing I'd heard. Anyway, I read the message to the staff at 6 o'clock, and the city room was packed, and I read the message, and the staff listened, and pictures of Otis went up all through the city room. And
are there to this day, many of them.
Are they there? Are they there to this day? Well, it was a memorable event at the paper, and I think his delivering that message was very important. Bettina told me that it also had something to do with the paper being sold, because these Chandlers over here.
He called them coupon clippers, not LaRouf's kind of coupons, but the millionaire kind of
waiting
coupons.
For the next dividend check.
Right.
Right, and they were, and anyway, as this unfolded, we had a story in the paper, you know, for the next day, and the publisher at the time, Catherine Downing, referred to Otis in the story as a bitter old man. Well, these Chandlers, you know. Look, who is she to talk that way of a Chandler? And that anger, plus the fact that they could see that the newspaper was going downhill fast, impelled them to sell the paper to the Chicago Tribune. Sam Zell bought it, and now you have the paper that some of you may even take at your home today.
And thank you for that. Before we go to questions, I want to ask Peter a stick it to the East Coast question, so I know you're going to rise to my bait. Yes. How hard was it to sell to PBS this documentary, which, after all, as they say about everything to do with Los Angeles, is just local? If it's New York,
right,
it's international. If it's Los Angeles, it's local.
Well, documentaries are generally made between Washington, D.C., Boston, and New York City. We call it the Bermuda Triangle. For documentarians, and for them to even consider a production company, a documentarian from the West Coast flying to Washington to make this pitch, really was a big deal. And I sold it as the real Citizen Kane meets the real Chinatown, starring the California Kennedys.
Of course.
Thank you. That was brilliant.
And it worked. But yes, that was the East Coast bias. I was aware of it, and we did get our money. But their criticisms and their comments really reflected a sense of not understanding the way things work out here, and a presumption that we should understand the way things work back there.
Now that it's won a Peabody Award, have they changed their tune?
We haven't heard from them.
That explains misspelling Chandler on the PBS website, yeah. Well, let's have some questions for you. We have people in the audience with microphones, and if you'll raise your hands, we're going to designate the first and then the on-deck speaker here. So why don't we go over, we have a hand here first, somebody? And then the next one, who have we got down here in front, please?
Are there any Chandlers, by the way? I do ask.
Too late.
No?
Could you tell us a little bit about what was in that message? What was that message? What did he want the staff to know?
As you can see, I got all teary just thinking about it. It was an incredible moment.
It was started out to the staff of the Los Angeles Times. I forget the exact words, the beleaguered, abused staff of the Los Angeles Times. And his message was about the legacy of a newspaper. And if a newspaper's honor is compromised in any way, no excuses, no remedial steps, no spin, nothing could ever put it back together once it has been compromised. And he said that the honor of the Los Angeles Times is dearer to me than life itself.
Down here, please.
I'd like to ask for some comment on a comparison between the Chandlers and the Sulzbergers, because it sounds like we have a petty little clan that couldn't hold itself together. But back on that evil East Coast, there's another clan that can.
That's true. Another clan, the Bancrofts, swore they'd never sell, and they did a couple of years ago to Rupert Murdoch. But the Sulzbergers are much more united as a family, with the way the stock is broken down into various classes, A, B, and C, and they do have to do everything unanimously for anything to get passed. So yes, they also have a sense of civic duty and a sense of a public trust, which is greater than just making money.
Over here, and then toward the back, Justin, for there.
This is a fascinating subject. It seems to me that in the era of early Hollywood, there were some pretty powerful egos around. Did the Chandlers ever sort of butt heads with, whether it's Howard Hughes at Douglas, or any of the studio heads at Warner Brothers or Paramount?
I'll tell you just one story. You know, Jack Warner was on the brink of bankruptcy in the mid-1920s, and no bank would loan him any money. And in part, it's because he was Jewish. Harry Chandler did loan him money, and with that money, Jack Warner revolutionized something called sound. So Harry Chandler was more or less involved in a big landmark moment in movie history. There are other stories, too, about how they brought out a guy named Will Hayes to police the Hollywood entertainment industry in the wake of the Fatty Arbuckle scandal. And Harry Chandler was integral in bringing Will Hayes back from Washington. He was the postmaster general at the time. And so Harry Chandler was involved with Hollywood, even though he disdained Hollywood because he was such a puritanical guy.
There's a question back there in the green shirt.
I know that Harry Chandler's papers were burned. Is there enough material for someone to write a fairly extensive biography of Harry Chandler?
I think there is. I talked to, I was out at the Huntington, and I talked to the a woman who's the archivist, and she's putting it all together. And she thinks that there is, that in among all this, once she gets it straightened out, that there really is. And I said to her, you know, she was telling me about it, and I said, you know, there's a great book in there, you know. And I said, I'm not going to write it, but there's really a great book one day, maybe in 10 or 20 years for someone. And she said, that's right. And she felt that the material, there was enough material there to make that possible.
Let's see. All right, go ahead, Louise.
You've given such a beautiful portrait of how the Times, gave LA an identity, both, created an identity, maintained an identity. Could any of you comment on, I hope the LA Times is here for a long time, but without that, without the Los Angeles Times, what defines this, what holds the city in the way that a newspaper can? How is there anything that can possibly play that role as the Times' influence diminishes, if it is? I think it is.
And there's some back there as well, too. Guys?
Oh, I was going to actually ask you.
I think that there are so few institutions that are shared institutions here. You know, the fortunes of the Dodgers and the Lakers being among them. Everybody can talk about traffic and the freeway experience, but just physically, the geography of Los Angeles is like a centrifuge, and it keeps pushing people farther and farther out. So I think that the overlap and the points of commonality are probably more undercut by the internet because people can find their niche interests. And we do form more coherent neighborhoods, but that doesn't mean we have a more coherent city. I think the overarching presence of the paper has served in the past, sometimes for ill in the old kind of oligarchy days, and more recently for the good, of kind of giving people a common platform for dialogue. And in the absence of it, I'm not sure. Bill?
No, I think that as imperfect as the paper was, even in its greatest days of trying to cover this vast area, it did bring the Southland together. That was a phrase that they had at the paper.
Made up.
I loved it so much. We had an editor, Dave Rosenzweig, who banned the use of the Southland.
And really?
I love that word so much, I snuck it in whenever I could, because that was...
Just to see him go all red in the face.
Oh, that's cute.
But that was what the Times brought together, from, as Jerry Dunphy said, from the mountain to the sea, and was a unifying force, and the news in the Times fed all of the television stations, and so it was just a common thread. It had the greatest sports writers. Jim Murray was a huge unifying force. I mean, and without that, I think that It's not, the region will not have that kind of unity.
There's someone here sorry about that. And then this fellow next, please. Thank you.
The LA Times' book editor, exceptional book editor, David Yulin, is about to step down, or depending how you look at it, up, to become the book critic. So I wonder if especially Bill, might remember anything of Otis's directives as he decided to, as the paper decided to start a freestanding book section, and what he looked for and found in Art Seidenbaum, its first editor.
The first book editor was Robert Kirsch, and what Otis thought, and as I said a little bit earlier, he saw a paper that had mass and class. Mass in that it would circulate everywhere. Class in that it would cover everything, including high culture. That had not been covered before, and the book section was very much a part of that, and movies, you know, and gossip. He had Joyce Haber, the gossip columnist, and sports. I mean, a sports section that could compete with the really good sports sections in the Examiner and in the in the other papers in LA. And so it was all part of a mix where when you bought the paper, there'd be something for everybody in that paper.
Including comics, unlike an East Coast paper that we can name. So right there, please.
I'm curious about there was a former LA Times employee, but this was a very long time ago, by the name of Morrill Mayo, who wrote a book that he published in 1933 called Los Angeles. And he had quite a bit about the bombing as well as about General Otis, and essentially earned the ire of General Otis and the Chandlers because of his uncovering of the Owens Valley. And I say that twice because from what I understand, the LA Times and all the other papers, all the other metropolitan dailies of that time, knew about what was going on for about 2 years, but the LA Times apparently scooped all the other papers by one day by acting like they had uncovered a conspiracy. And I'm curious to know, if you're familiar with that book, how much truth is in there in those chapters by Morrill Mayo. It was 1933, but it was pretty contemporary and quickly went out of print, from what I understand, as a direct result of upsetting Otis Chandler because of the Owens Valley.
And it wouldn't have been Otis then, it would have been his...
Well, I mean the Chandlers, but I mean because of what it had to say about that, and it was ultimately also cited as source material for Chinatown.
Right.
If you're familiar.
All I know is that he was a radical socialist, and that didn't mix very well with the Chandler philosophy of capitalism. That's all I know about Morrill Mayo, and I know he has been quoted also by a wonderful writer named Carrie McWilliams, who's also left-wing, but very articulate and a brilliant writer and a reporter.
And an indispensable...
Yes, resource. Mm-hmm.
Bill, do you know about that book?
I knew... I don't know if he worked for the LA Times. I know that he was a left-wing historian, and he was, as Peter said, he was extremely influential with Carrie McWilliams, and... his interpretation of the Owens Valley, which was based on reporting, was pretty much shaped Carrie's view of the Owens Valley thing, and that really became history too. I mean, he was very influential. He may have worked for the Times, but I just don't know about that.
There's one book I do remember, and this one supposedly, again, and you may know, Peter, the Times tried to suppress, was called Billion Dollar Blackjack. And it had a fabulous noir cover of the nighttime skyline of Los Angeles and this shadowy figure carrying a club that turned out to be a rolled-up copy of the LA Times. And it was written by what was like the brother of some old county supervisor.
His name was Benelli, yeah.
Benelli, right. You know, Frank, like Frank G. Frank Benelli, Benelli Regional Park. Yeah. And that was a book the Times supposedly tried to find to get suppressed, but I found it all over the internet, so it couldn't have done
right.
a very
they,
good
they,
job of trying to
They bought
to
up
it.
Every copy, as I recall, when it came out.
But I just, but the cover art is just fantastically worth it. So, yeah, let's go here, and then we'll go back over to this side. Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, Louise.
During the very conservative times prior to Otis's ascent, what was happening at the Hearst Herald Examiner? Was it the more liberal paper? Was it a union paper? Did the Hearst family have any involvement in the city like the Chandlers did at the Times?
Tell them the story of the mirror, Bill.
Hmm? The mirror?
Yeah, the deal that Norman Chandler made
right.
with the Hearst.
Norman Chandler wanted to get a piece of the afternoon market and started an afternoon paper called The Mirror, which was actually a very lively, terrific tabloid paper. But in 1962, the two families reached a sensible agreement where Mr. Chandler would close down his afternoon paper, The Mirror, and Hearst would close down his morning paper, The Examiner, and make it an afternoon paper called The Herald Examiner. As with so many of Hearst's business decisions, it was incredibly stupid because afternoon papers were on their way out. And so.
And television news was on the cusp of getting big.
Was getting big. And so the Times had the morning feel to it itself, and that was really which set the stage for great growth there. So I guess you could say their relationship was a sensible business relationship.
Something over here. There we go.
Don't forget the back for questions.
Oh, I'm so sorry. We'll get back there right after this one.
When I was a lad 70 years ago, I had the choice of either working for the Times or the Herald, delivering their papers.
You picked the lighter paper, I hope.
It No, the Times is always heavier. The Times had a lot of advertising in it, so they really could afford to pay their carriers. The Herald said, if you don't collect what you delivered, you're out the money. So it was always better to work for the Times,
wow.
even though it was non-union, than it was to work for the Herald.
The right. The Times is very paternalistic in that way,
yes.
in looking after employees. If you walk through the halls of the Times, you see the old in-house newspaper. It had employee picnics and funds for babies being born and that sort of thing. So there was a kind of paternalism
yeah.
to that.
But I always would say, you know, to people who were downgrading what it was like in the content in the 30s and 40s, that the Times did have a lot more features in it than the Herald or the Examiner. That at that time it was mostly, this town was a race town, and you put out editions so that people could go to the races, and that was not a forte of the Times.
Yeah. Back in here, please.
Thank you. A little bit of trivia before I ask a question. About 5 minutes ago, they were talking about the Times initiated a book section with Robert Hirsch. And I must confess, I do take a little bit of credit for this because our family had a bookshop on Hollywood Boulevard. And we kept pestering all of the Times management, why don't you give us a book section? Why don't you give us a book section? And their reply was, we can't support a book section because we don't have enough advertisers. So my father and I kept pestering the New York publishers, telling them we did have a market for books. And finally, they did open up a book section for us. We advertised for it. And a lot of people can knock the Times for good reason. But our family business prospered from the Chandler family because as we advertised more books, we sold more books. I had more bookshops.
Can I interrupt before you ask your question? What was the name of your shop?
It was called Pickwick Bookshop. It's
small. Oh.
The people that are applauding are showing their age because
I have to tell you that both Larry McMurtry and Ray Bradbury have told me how much they adored haunting the bookshops on Hollywood Boulevard, which were in some cases open till midnight, which served as their kind of library and certainly a place for them to go.
Fortunately, there are some good bookshops still around, like Book Soup, that continue the tradition. Question. In all of the books I've been reading about the Chandler family and Harrison Gray Otis, we all know that Harrison Gray Otis's daughter, one of his daughters, married Harry Chandler, I think Marion.
Marion.
But what happened to the other part of the Harrison Gray Otis family? Did they succeed in obtain any of the funds or inheritances or the wealth?
One of them, they actually lived down below. Harry Chandler built a house in Los Feliz, and Mabel was one of the names of Marion's sisters. There were two sisters of Marion Chandler, and the General Otis had three daughters. And one of them, Mabel, was the mother of Franklin Booth, whose son Otis Booth Jr. became a compadre of Berkshire Hathaway's Charlie Munger and Warren Buffett, and he made $5 billion, and he was the general's great-great-grandson.
Okay, and another quick question. I remember reading in the LA Weekly about 15 years ago, Camilla Frost Chandler, Otis's sister, she married a fellow named Frost, who apparently ingratiated himself to the family, and supposedly he had a hand in the undoing of Otis. Yeah. And my question is, how good was the relationship between Otis and his sister Camilla? Was she loyal to him in all of this?
I'm really not as certain as I think you might know more.
Well, Camilla went on a plane to Chicago to solidify the deal with Tribune, and Otis didn't know a thing about the deal that went down with the Tribune merger. And in our film, there's a moment where Camilla tells Otis on the phone what has happened, and she says it was a surprise and it was a difficult moment for both of us, but she sided with, as Bill has characterized them, this over here. So that caused a rift.
I'm being given the sign. So some of us are going to be around. I think we'll all be around for a little while. And Bill will be selling his books out there. Peter's there to talk to you. Do you have is the documentary out there as well?
No.
Okay, but you can see the documentary. And I want to thank the library and aloud. The library is a civic university. Please support the library and please support aloud.
Aloud Audio is produced by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, Righteous Persons Foundation, Errant Fox, City National Bank, Deloitte, K&L Gates, KPMG, Wallace Foundation, the Bujakchi Foundation, Dean Hansel, and Donna and Martin J. Wolfe. Media support provided by KPCC, 83.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.